You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. I need a vacation to recover from my vacation. Do you ever have that feeling? It's like, whoa. Oh, man. The New York Times today, in an editorial by the editorial board, came out and said Ed Snowden should be given. They didn't use the word amnesty or pardon, but clemency was the word that they used. And in other words, you know, cut the guy some slack. I think, you know, what they're suggesting is, you know, let him plead guilty to something that gets him a year in jail kind of thing. But he's certainly looking at a minimum of 10, 20 years in jail for the things he's already been charged with. And as the New York Times editorial board points out, if he shows up, it'll be enough to be life in jail. Which raises the question, if Edward Snowden is a hero and a whistleblower, what's Chelsea Manning? Isn't she one too? And so, anyway, there are a lot of things I want to share with you today, and we'll just kind of leave the lines open, as it were. You know, pretty much anything you want to talk about is fine with me too. 10 hopeful things that happened in 2013. I wanted to talk about, I think it's Jahi McMath, this young girl, this 13-year-old girl who went to the hospital to have her tonsils out. And somebody screwed up something, and she's now brain dead. She was declared brain dead a couple of weeks before Christmas. And her parents want to keep her body, or keep her, I mean, depending on how you look at this, want to keep her alive, which is possible with a feeding tube and a ventilator, as long as possible. Presumably in the hopes that she will just like suddenly wake up or something, but maybe they just, you know, want to keep her there. I'm not inside their minds, and they haven't, to the best of my knowledge, provided any great details on their thinking. The Terri Schiavo Foundation has gotten involved in this and says that they should be allowed to keep her alive. The hospital is saying basically, she meets the California state definition of dead. She is a dead person. And so they should not have to engage in any further medical services for her because she's dead. And this is, you know, apparently, now here's the problem. You go looking for stories of people who've been declared brain dead and then woke up, and what you get is stuff like from Breitbart and the Straits Times in Singapore. Not exactly the most credible sources. Huffington Post had one. This woman had done a massive overdose, and then she woke up. This is very, very rare. But she had not been through all the tests that this girl has been through. So, but what it's coming down to is, or what I think it's going to come down to, and this is where it gets really tough, is, oh, that's sweet. Sue Nethercutt just sent me a Happy New Year with a logo. Hi, Sue. Thank you for that. In our chat room, you can drop in and say hi over at TomHartman.com. It's free. In any case, where this is going to come down, I think, is should the hospital have the authority or the power to say, this girl is dead, we're going to turn off the machines, when the parents don't want them to. And the parents are talking about, we will transport her to a facility that will care for her. Now, I'm sure that facility will care for her at quite a price, and because this is a 13-year-old girl who went into a, have her tonsils removed, and she's now brain dead, I'm guessing that there's some significant money at play here. That the facility that would care for this girl or for her body, however you want to describe it, is going to make some serious bucks. I mean, you know, what a lifetime of caring for basically a dead person. So on the one hand, you know, is that right that the hospital should be able to say, she's dead, sorry, see you later, you know? We're sending her to the coroner. Or should they have just done that in the ER and never involved the parent? You know, I don't know how this all played out. Or should the family be able to say, you know, we're going to do it our way, and if we can get a court to award us a damage settlement from the, presumably the insurance company from the hospital, that's going to be enough to keep our daughter alive for years, or weeks or months, whatever their intention is, we're going to do that. And I think I could probably argue either side of that, although common sense, my personal sensibility, let's say, I don't think it's necessarily common sense, but my personal sensibility is that if it were me, and Louise and I had this conversation this morning, she said, you know, if I'm ever brain dead, pull the plug, please. And I said, yeah, ditto. Same here. You know, I would not want her to have to spend the rest of her life fretting about, you know, whether I'm getting bed sores or whatever. And when there's no me there, you know. But on the other hand, you know, I'm the parent of three children. And if it was my own kid and there was even a thousandth of a percent hope, and the hospital's insurance would pay for it, might I not say, well, you know, let's hang on there? I mean, this is one of those never walked a mile in their shoes, so I don't know things. I find it fascinating. Just fascinating. The NSA program, by the way, which I think this really should be called the Bush NSA program, that the New York Times is saying, let's not prosecute Snowden over releasing the details on this thing, the Bush NSA program. The White House review panel on NSA surveillance said that this program has not stopped any terrorist attacks. Really? All this money, all this time, all this effort, all these billions of dollars to these private contractors. And meanwhile, I've got, oh, this is cute from today's, I'm sure this started on Facebook, given the format, but it's picture Jimmy Carter. It says, good morning, I'm Jimmy Carter. Today's my 88th birthday. I created 10.3 million jobs in my single term when the top tax rate was 70%. I created more jobs than four of the last five Republican presidents. No wonder the Republicans want to write off my presidency as a failure. Isn't that great? Bernie Sanders has laid out a basically, you know, I think a platform for the Democratic Party to run on. And Ronald sent me a platform based on my book, The Crash of 2016, he said, you know, here's what I got out of this. Think about this. An interesting list, 10 hopeful things that happened in 2013 that we will get to from Yes Magazine. There's a bunch of interesting stuff I want to get to today.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And perhaps most important, the public health crisis that is being caused by the unemployment crisis among our young people. I'll tell you about that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Nate Sweet, producer with The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good, good. So, Edward Snowden and clemency, what do you think?
I think it's an interesting prospect. I would certainly agree with it. I don't know if it's going to happen, but
I can predict it won't.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty safe bet. Might be safer than bidding on a lot of things. So put your money on that one. But, I mean, it's still, I think it's still significant that you have two of the most important newspapers in the country, in the world probably, and now some former Obama administration officials saying that they're sympathetic toward the idea of giving Snowden clemency, especially in the wake of one NSA official in that, you know, very appropriately criticized 60 Minutes interview. He said he was open to the idea of amnesty for or a pardon.
Yeah, although he's walked that back since then.
Right.
He wants to keep his job. But anyhow, we're going to discuss that with Mike Paventoni, along with a few other things.
Right. We're going to tie that to sort of the ongoing state of whistleblower laws in the United States and the new ruling by a judge in New York, by Judge Corman, that border officials can randomly search your laptop or any other – they can search the contents of your laptop or any other electronic devices without a warrant at border crossings and
right,
trains.
Because that's merely an inconvenience.
Right, right. He said there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in that moment, and I think Papp will disagree with that. So
yeah, I suspect, although in this case, I mean, this kid, this young man had both an American and a French passport.
Right.
He had been to a couple of Islamic countries. He had had the visas in his French passport, not his American passport. And when they opened his laptop, they
kind
saw pictures.
Headable images, right?
Yeah, Hamas and stuff like that. And it was like, you know, what's going on here?
I think he was an Islamic studies scholar. So
he was.
It would make sense.
He was. He was working on his PhD.
Yeah.
But, you know, he had the beard and the whole bit. And he just, I mean, you know, he from the point of view of this border agent, hey, maybe we've got one here. Let's take a look. And this is one of those ones, too, where.
I mean, I guess the instance would be, do we really want border security agents taking, you know, judge, jury, and executioner on themselves? Do
well, but they didn't play executioner. I mean, what they did was, this is the fine line between reasonable cause and, what's the phrase? Reasonable suspicion and probable cause, right? And reasonable suspicion can lead to essentially an arrest. And that's what they did, not an arrest, but a stop, like a traffic stop. And what the government is arguing is that's what they did with this guy's computer. Probable cause is necessary for prosecution, and they didn't do that.
Right. This probably wouldn't have led to a trial, but
right.
It could have led to obviously, you know, law enforcement taking action against him.
So anyway, I'm of two minds on that one.
Yeah.
Anyhow, CTAX minimum wage workers might not get their raise. Really?
Right. It's one of the big progressive pieces of legislation that passed this in November in the elections. But some of the city's employers have filed suit to try to block that measure from going into effect. And it's interesting, it sort of came about, this news of the suit came about at the same time as Bill de Blasio was inaugurated. So we're going to have Richard Eskow come on the show, talk about, you know, the emerging sense that there's a progressive push in the Democratic Party and seeing whether or not, you know, whether that's going to be successful and not giving the odds that are stacked up against it.
Right. And Kevin Camps is going to drop by from Beyond Nuclear.
Yeah, the sailors from the USS Ronald Reagan who helped out with the Fukushima cleanup are refiling suit because they claim radiation poisoning.
Yeah, they are sick as a dog, these young men.
Not being reported at all in the mainstream media, but we'll have it here in the big picture.
There you go. Nate Sweet. Thanks a lot, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. I'll see you in a couple hours. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harmon here with you. I'm going to start playing around with some, getting some good royalty-free indie music for our bumpers, you know. We can do a lot with that. Anyway, 7 ripoffs the capitalists would like to keep out of the media. This was in Common Dreams before the end of the year, but it's worthy of note. I'm just going to throw a few things out here, and then, you know, after the bottom of the hour, we'll pick up your phone calls. We've already got 7 lines lit up right now, but hang on, and I will get to you, I promise. Number one, corporations are profiting from food stamps. Yes, they are. The banksters who handle the money, and of course, the J.P. Morgan in particular, Xerox and e-funds. Crash the economy, get your money back, as the financial industry did. Die with a student loan, stay in debt. Yes, if you die with your student loan, well, if any of my kids die with their student loans, I'm going to have to pay them off because I co-signed them. And this is, you know, not only are they taking the money of the millennials and the Gen Xers, but if they croak, they're taking their boomer parents' money. 70% of corporations aren't required to pay any federal taxes. Lotteries pay for corporate tax avoidance. The NFL pays no federal taxes. You can live on Park Avenue and get a farm subsidy. Yes, it's true. How to turn a dollar into $100,000. Basically, you know, go in the business of selling printer ink or bottled water. So this is capitalism. But this public health crisis thing, I thought this was fascinating. This over Common Dreams today. Sarah Lazare is a staff writer for Common Dreams. And the headline is Nothing to Live For: Youth Unemployment, Depression, and Austerity. New study finds long-term youth unemployment taking severe mental toll. And basically what they're finding is that young people, 40% of jobless young people, and there's a lot of jobless young people out there, and there's they did 2,161 interviews, and this is all in the UK, but I think we can reasonably extrapolate. We've had Reaganomics for 32 years, they've had Thatcheronomics for 34 years, so it's basically the same thing. 40% of jobless young people have faced symptoms of mental illness, including suicidal thoughts, feelings of self-loathing, and panic attacks as a direct result of unemployment. Nearly a third have contemplated suicide. That youth unemployment, and it's not just youth unemployment, of course. The other big unreported story is the people who are in their 50s and early 60s who are being laid off, who are losing their jobs because, you know, companies like Bain Capital come in and buy up their company, and they lay off the most highly paid people, who are typically the people who've been around longest. And then those folks, you know, can't find a job because they're, you know, 50-year-olds who are making, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 bucks a year can't find a job like that again. And then when they try to compete with 20-year-olds for a $20,000 a year job, the employer won't hire them. They'll hire the 20-year-old because they're figuring this guy's going to wait and get a, you know, he's always going to be looking for the old, better job. And they, the boomers, the older people, end up with no job at all for years and years. And then John Boehner comes along, and Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan, and says, oh, and by the way, to hell with their unemployment insurance, and cuts them off. Which takes us back to Wednesday, September 18th, 2002, when the BBC published More Suicides Under Conservative Rule. The suicide rate under conservative governments increases. This was not an op-ed. This was an actual news story. This Australian team analyzed suicide statistics from 1901 to 1998. And then they looked at the political regimes. They took into account periods of drought and World War II and factored them out. And after adjusting for these factors, the figures clearly, I'm quoting from the BBC, the figures clearly show the highest rates of suicide occurred when both conservative state and federal governments were in power. At the very end, they say, overall, they say, the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had conservatives not been in power, equivalent to one suicide every day of the 20th century or two for every day that the conservatives ruled. So is it time for us? I mean, this is like, and I just want to remind you, apropos of this article that I shared with you back the first week of December. Jesus Malverde had reposted it over at DU, and it originally came from the BBC. And, you know, the rats where you put them in the cage and they just hit cocaine, and keep taking the cocaine until they die? You can replicate that experiment all day long, and it always does the same thing. The rats will take the cocaine until they die, as long as they are locked up in a little tiny cage. Now, if you were in a jail cell and you were offered an unlimited amount of cocaine until you die, might you not do that too? But when they put the rats in what they call a rat park, in other words, an area that's like the size that a normal rat would, you know, it's thousands of square feet, and the rats can run, and they got places to hide and play and other rats and, you know, food. And when they put them in the rat park, and over in the corner, there's the cocaine distribution thing. Every now and then, the rat will go over and get a little hit of cocaine and get high. But they don't kill themselves. Isn't there a lesson for all of us in this? I mean, the kind of pressure that a crappy economy produces is leading to problems like addiction, suicide, mental illness. This is a public health crisis. Capitalism has failed. Crony capitalism is killing us. Our government has been taken over by big, you know, transnational corporations because of a doctrine from the Supreme Court. And there are a couple of fairly simple solutions to this. And the first one is to make the government the employer of last resort like FDR did.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In other words, real simple. Bring back the WPA and the CCC. Put everybody who wants to work back to work with a good paying job. And finally, George W. Bush. Bless him. St. George. He promised to free Iraq of Al-Qaeda. Now, the debate that went on in Fox News for over 2 years was whether one Al-Qaeda guy had ever had a conversation with, and I think it was in Belgium or something, with one guy who worked for Saddam Hussein. This was the basis that Don Rumsfeld and George Bush wanted to invade Iraq on. Oh, they had a connection to Al-Qaeda, you know. But there was no Al-Qaeda operating in Iraq because Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein hated each other. Al-Qaeda wanted to run the country according to Islamic principles, and Saddam Hussein ran a secular nation. No official religion. You don't have to follow the religious dictates. Women could wear pants, they could work, they could go to college, they could drive, they could show their elbows. Al-Qaeda wanted to change all that. So we went over and we spent trillions of dollars, probably $4 or $5 trillion when all was said and done. Easily enough to send every young person who wants to go to college for the next 3 decades for free. We went over there and we spent that, and that, not to mention 4,000 or 5,000 American lives and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives, and we screwed up the lives of at least 5 million Iraqis who were displaced, who had to move, whose lives were ruined. We covered the country with depleted uranium. There's an explosion in birth defects, all to keep Al-Qaeda out of Iraq. Let me read you the headline in the New York Times at this moment, and then I will pick up your phone calls. Parts of two key Iraqi cities fall to Al-Qaeda group active in Syria. And then the lead paragraph. Radical Sunni militants aligned with Al-Qaeda freed prisoners, torched police stations, and seized mosques on Thursday in Fallujah and Ramadi, two of Iraq's most important cities. George Bush. There has to be a special place in hell reserved for people who lie their countries into war. And well, I was going to say, and don't even do it competently, but that kind of minimizes the impact of what I was saying. Anyhow, Helena, or is it Helena in Fort Lauderdale, Florida?
Yes, it's Selena.
Hi, Helena. You wanted to talk about the case of this young woman who is apparently brain dead.
Yes, and you know, there's two sides to every story, and I actually worked with a woman who was in her late 40s, who in her 30s was brain dead for 30 days.
Hmm.
Her family couldn't bring themselves to unplug the machine, okay? Right. Back then, though, they didn't have all these transplants and everything, so they didn't hound you every 20 minutes for the organs. And healthcare was more focused on the patient than it was on the money. I also had a fiance who was on life support, and 3 days later, they disconnected everything, which I wasn't married to him at the time, and it drove me crazy because I wanted to give him at least 30 days.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you never know.
Yeah.
I've met people who had organ transplants and have lived on to see their grandkids. I understand both sides, mm-hmm. but I don't think if a family doesn't want to disconnect the machine, let it be. Don't disconnect the machine.
Yeah.
Because at some point, the life support machine will fail, and that person will go away regardless. Okay, and there's a point where the body just can't do it anymore, and they actually, you know, they actually die, which is why they were every 20 minutes when my fiance was on life support, they were there every 20 minutes asking for their organs. Because they said at some point, you know, his body's, the machine's not going to be able to support him, and then we can't harvest them, and blah, blah, blah. Mm. So, you know, a lot of people say, oh, she's brain dead and just give up. No. Let the family deal with it. They want to keep her on life support, then keep her on life support. If that's how you want to, and if that's what your gut is telling you, then do what your gut says. You know, it's just this health care in this country has gotten ridiculous.
Well, I don't think this is so much a comment on our health care system as it is. I mean, most. Well, I don't think this is about health care. I think it's about ethics. This is a question of. Who should be able to make the decision? Should it be her family or should it be her doctors about when she's dead and when to give up? And you're making a, you know, your personal conviction is that it should be her family. I'm inclined to agree, although I would say I would be the first person to sign an advance declaration. And in fact, I think I have that says that if I'm in the condition of this young girl, pull the plug, please.
Exactly. Because let me tell you, having been in that situation, people need to do living wills. Yeah. Because I've already told my family, no organs. No. I go with everything. I'll apologize to everybody who dies that day with me who didn't get my organs. When I get to heaven, I'll tell them, I'm sorry, dude, it was just not meant to be.
Yeah.
But I don't want my family having to go through those decisions for me. You know what I'm saying? Because...
Yeah.
Having been there, it's an impossible decision.
Oh yeah, yeah, and where this gets really difficult is that this is a 13-year-old girl, and she couldn't have signed an advance directive to begin with, and even if she did, it would have been contested as you know she's not an adult. Helena, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for your thoughtful commentary on that. Jeffrey in New York, hey Jeffrey, what's up?
Hi, Mr. Hartman. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you too.
Happy family. Thank you. I agree with the previous caller.
Mm-hmm.
I'm under the suspicion that there, because this Dr. David Durand, he's the Children's Hospital's chief pediatric officer,
mm-hmm.
and that he's too anxious to pull a plug.
Yeah,
I suspect that that hospital, that whatever it is, the harvesting agency, organ harvesting agency. They just want to harvest the organs.
You think they want to pull the plugs because they want the organ? I mean, you know, that is going to be, I mean, there are long waiting lists for organs, and so it literally will mean that somebody could live or die as a consequence of this. But on the other hand, you would go with the Terry Schiavo path and say, let the family keep her alive, keep her body alive, keep her alive as long as.
I wouldn't categorize her as a Terry Schiavo,
mm-hmm.
but as a personal issue.
Yeah.
And it's a personal issue to the family, and I think that it's just that they want to harvest her organs. That's what I believe they want to do.
Yeah.
And I say the family should sue them.
Well, I'm sure they will.
Get their own pathologist to find out what happened to her.
Right.
What caused her to go into this? It's a tonsillectomy. Come on.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and
no, obviously something went very wrong, and it probably went wrong with the anesthesia. Although who knows? I mean, lots of things can happen during surgery. It's why you sign all these forms, you know, that say basically, if you die, then you know, hey, that's you know, you went in knowing that you were taking the chance. But Jeffrey, thank you for weighing in. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. David in Chicago. Hey, David.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good.
Happy New Year, by
Thank
the way.
You. And the same back at you.
Yeah, actually, I was commenting on the young girl. I don't personally, you know, believe that we have enough neuroscience knowledge to actually say whether she's brain dead or not. Because we, you know, like that one caller before has said, we've had many comatose patients or that were assumed brain dead wake up, you know, 3, 4 years.
Well, actually, we haven't had many. We've had, there have apparently been a few, and there are neuroscientists who dispute that those people were correctly diagnosed as brain dead to begin with. But, you know, let's say that this does happen. It happens so very rarely. But still, when it does happen, it gets publicized like crazy. You know, all the Terry Schiavo folks come out of the woodwork but I think it's much more rare than you think. We did a literature search this morning on this and could not find any cases that were, you know, good, clear, solid, back it up, good science, where, you know, everybody agreed this person is brain dead and then they came back. I couldn't find one. But there may be one out there. But
well, that's
in any
the
case.
Problem is,
pardon?
Again, we just don't know enough about the brain. That's, I mean, we know lots about every other part of the body, but most even neuroscientists will tell you they don't know enough about the brain.
Yeah. Okay, so that's, okay, I got it. David, thank you for the call. Chris in White River, Arizona. Chris, we just have a minute of the break. You had some thoughts on Edward Snowden?
Yeah, on Edward Snowden, I was in intelligence and, you know, the man may be guilty, he may not be guilty, you know, that's for the courts to decide. But he did bring out a very interesting topic about, you know, all this, you know, NSA snooping.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, too much information makes no information.
Yeah.
And the more they look, the worse it gets.
No, I agree. I think this is bad for the NSA. It's bad for the country. And the problem that Ed Snowden had was that because he worked for a private corporation, he had no whistleblower protections. And the president came out and said, well, you know, I signed a whistleblower law. Well, that would have applied if Ed Snowden worked for the NSA, but he didn't. He worked for Booz Allen Hamilton, which was owned by, you know, the Carlyle Group, which is owned by, in part, the Bin Laden family. So that's, you know, unfortunate. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I find it interesting the Jaheim McMath case, the people saying keep her alive. Could that money be used to save somebody else's life? Welcome back. And Barbara, watching Free Speech TV in Helena, Montana. Hey, we had a caller earlier named Helena. Or it's Helena, Montana. Now, how do you say it, Barbara?
Helena,
okay. So she's
yeah.
She, anyway,
I've talked to you before, Tom. How are you today?
I am fine, thank you. I hope you are well.
I'm good. Anytime I get a chance to plug Jimmy Carter, I like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he was the greatest president.
I think he was
of my life.
I think he was probably the greatest president of my lifetime. And he's certainly the only one other than Dwight Eisenhower who didn't have a war. Well, Eisenhower had a few wars, I guess, who didn't have a war during his presidency, who didn't create a war. So.
Well, and who has lived a life of such honor and dignity from that point forward.
And one of the few who didn't cash in. I mean, Bill Clinton's worth hundreds of millions of dollars now, and Jimmy Carter's whatever, you know, he's still a peanut farmer.
He's a real authentic, genuine person.
Yeah, I agree.
About the case of the young 13-year-old.
Jaheim McMath.
You know, I have a problem with for-profit hospitals and the insurance companies making any health care decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can't get rid of the fraudulent corruption that is taking place in our healthcare system, there are no answers for any of us in any kind of crisis.
Yeah, but this is not a situation where, you know, some giant bureaucracy is saying, well, you know, in our rule book, line 7, page 34, it says.
Right.
This is an actual doctor.
I know. I've had people in critical conditions in my lifetime, and one of them was hooked up to a machine hit by a train.
Ouch.
So they unplugged him, and he died. I'm okay that they unplugged him, and I'm not voting for her to be unplugged.
Yeah.
But if we have a medical system where we don't have one payer, we can never have justice or fairness in any of our processes of thinking of what the right way, there is a method of thinking right that only comes when we line up the inside of our heart with whatever the outside circumstances are.
But if we had a single-payer system, Barbara, there would be more incentive to pull a plug on this girl so that the resources could be used to save a half a dozen other people's lives.
Well, we're going to have to come to some real decision-making about
how to deal with this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. Barbara, thank you for the call. I don't have an easy answer or a glib answer for this other than, you know, just if it's me, pull the plug, please. And that's about as on the record as you can get, I guess. 10 minutes before the hour, we'll be right. Media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Sue reminds me that the study where I was talking about the rats eating cocaine over and over again, and I wasn't reading it as a rat addicted to heroin is not rebelling against this. It was heroin, actually. Actually, morphine, which is to which heroin is converted in the body. So, morphine hydrochloride. But anyway, the principle still applies. I thought that was interesting. And Carbolic Cubilist says, you know, why don't we have Bill Frist, you know, check a videotape and determine whether the girl's alive or not. I mean, you know, he's done that before. Priscilla in Delavan, Wisconsin?
Yes, uh-huh.
Hi, Priscilla.
Hi.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for
Hi,
calling.
Tom. Love you.
Thank you.
Listen, my daughter was in college, and she had a blood clot to her brainstem for birth control pills.
Ooh.
6 years ago.
Uh-huh.
They told me she was brain dead, but she was really locked in. She had the locked-in syndrome, which is typical of people who have a problem with the brainstem. It's a stroke, but it didn't hit the brain. It hit the brainstem.
Yeah.
Anyway, the doctor at the time, the neurologist, used to be the personal physician of the Shah of Iran.
Wow.
And remember Shah?
Oh, yeah.
He told me that she was brain dead. Mm-hmm. He was saying that she was brain dead because, well, first of all, they wanted me to harvest the organs. And secondly, I figured out that they were telling me this because they don't want families to have to go through all the trouble of, you know, having this happen. Well, anyway, I've been taking care of her for 16 years at home, and she can enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.
She spells with her eyes. She can remember things from when we were little. I ask her, well, what was that person's name, blah, 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 you know, when you were little, and she'll remember. She designs cards just by moving her eyes.
Mm.
No, she can't. She's on a ventilator. She can't move. She can't smile.
Mm-hmm.
She can't talk, but she looks up for yes and down for no.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a nice life here at home. We have wonderful friends and families. Some nurses come and help me. She can't be alone, so, you know, if I have to go somewhere
sure.
or something, we have nurses.
Sure.
And she has a nice life. She's happy. loves animals. We have two cats.
Yeah.
She likes to watch TV. We watch sometimes. We love you.
Yeah, thank you. I get it. And I, in fact, I watched my father go through this the last couple of days of his life. He had a stroke and he was locked in. And he could not move. He could not speak. But I'm quite sure clearly understood everything that was going on around him. And when I look back on it, I didn't realize that until maybe the last hour of his life. I would have done and said things probably quite differently during the couple of days that I was with him. But I didn't know about locked-in syndrome at the time. But
she looks vegetative.
Mm-hmm.
Three states of unconsciousness. There's vegetative, there's minimally conscious, and there's locked in.
Right.
Well, the people usually who have been mistakenly called, you know, vegetative are probably really minimally conscious, and they're every so often will come out, not like you said, it's very rare, very
mm-hmm.
rare.
Mm-hmm.
But so to the degree of the severity of the brainstem stroke, such as my daughter has, there have been people who've partially recovered
mm-hmm.
Due to the degree of the blockage.
Right. Yeah. It's got to be a tough one. Priscilla, I honor your commitment to your daughter, and thank you for calling and sharing your story with us.
Okay. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks. Happy New Year. I hope it's a good one. Claude in Monroe, New York. Hey, Claude. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How you doing, Tom? Glad to get on the show.
Thank
I'd
you.
Like to concur with the woman who thought Jimmy Carter was a great president.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was, too. I think the economical royals tanked the economy on him so he wouldn't get reelected.
Well, but what happened was, you know, Reagan cut a deal, Casey,
know
you know,
no,
with
I
the
know
Iranians
that,
to hold the hostages.
Know, they ruined the economy around him. It was a, remember,
sure.
they had the gas lines and
oh,
all
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they couldn't shoot him like they did Kennedy, so they decided to ruin him economically. You know?
Well, the Arab oil embargo actually did that.
Yes.
You know,
but
anyhow.
Well, I wanted to. One thing I did want to bring up to you is one of my friends who was Norwegian said one time, he said, the real problem with America is that everything is for sale. And I always go back to that. I did want to tell you that I joined amend.org. I got online.
Move to amend.
Listening to your program, and
I'm
going to get very active and involved with it. I think that's the only thing that can be done. It seems kind of hopeless.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you think about how bad it's been. I'm 62 years old. And I remember America when it was prosperous and when you could just go out and get a job and work hard, or two or three jobs and work hard and get ahead. And it seems like that's not here anymore. My wife lost her job. She just got cut off the unemployment benefits. She worked all her life since she was 17, lost a job, worked for one company for 21 years, fell down, broke her hand in nine places, went out on comp. When she came back after 4 months, they started to abuse her, and finally they let her go.
Wow.
And it's like unbelievable. It's like there's no protections for workers anymore. There's no loyalty to people. You know, my wife worked on this job for 21 years. And it's like, and the people that own the business are multimillionaires. You know, they own like nine car dealerships, you know. And it's just like, doesn't anybody in America care anymore about, you know, people who work for you?
I think, you know, because the system is essentially sociopathic. I mean, the capitalism is a sociopathic system, which is why it needs regulation. You know, it needs a conscience, right, which is what sociopaths lack. We have to regulate capitalism or re-regulate it, and we have been deregulating it consistently ever since the beginning of the Reagan era. And so, yeah, we've reached a point where the sociopaths and the sociopathic institutions are running everything. And I think you identified it, Claude. And good on you for signing up with movetoamend.org and making that your commitment for this year. I think that's a great New Year's resolution, whether you intended it that way or not. That's a great one. Claude, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for watching us there in Monroe, New York. We will be right back. It is a minute and a half before you.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Excuse me. Grief. And Mike Papantonio on the line with us, the attorney, the author, he is an author. The attorney, the author, the host of Ring of Fire Radio, and ringoffireradio.com, and Ring of Fire TV, which is also over at ringoffireradio.com. Hey, Pap, how you doing?
Tom, Happy New Year, my friend.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. I hope that 2014 is your best so far. I'm assuming you saw the New York Times editorial board's editorial, front page editorial today.
Sure, Snowden editorial.
Yeah. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I had some other thoughts as I was reading it. For some reason, there hasn't been real focus in what Snowden has done for us from a standpoint of not just government involvement, but from the standpoint of what have we done, what are we now thinking about as far as corporations taking virtually everything we have from us as they choose. The best example, that right now you see big pushback from Google, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Skype, all of them pushing back on this concept of PRISM, P-R-I-S-M. And what we find is that the gatekeepers of these various private entities were feeding information to the NSA. And I think that's important because a lot of times the market starts taking care of itself. What's popped up now, Tom, I don't know if you follow this story with DuckDuckGo Dot. DuckDuckGo Dot is this it's privacy-protecting search engine that is increased their, I think they said they increased their market something like 70 to 80% just since the NSA issue started to develop. Yeah. So the market to that degree takes care of itself when we finally understand that, you know, that our most private thoughts are now part of a search engine that if we broadcast our location, we're willing to do that for virtually every time we're asked on our iPad or on an iPhone, where are you? We'll tell them that. Our cars can be tracked for insurance discounts, selling, on and on. Text can be, in Instagrams can be instantly downloaded somewhere else, any pictures that we might send. So, you know, to me, the Snowden story, although we focused on government, it's a very, very important part of it, obviously, it's because the Fourth Amendment is just being trampled on. I love the aspect of focusing on what is happening with corporate America that's using all this information that Snowden's been telling us about.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the important points, and they pointed this out in the editorial, was when President Obama was asked, you know, might you cut this guy some slack? He said, I signed, whistleblower protection. But Snowden was working for Booz Allen Hamilton, which was, previously owned by the Carlyle Group, which was previously owned in part by the Bin Laden family. Mm-hmm. And he was not working for the U.S. government. So the whistleblower protection did not apply to him.
Mm. And that's a stretched argument. They use that argument any way they want to use the argument.
Right.
If you have a corporate entity that is quasi-government, they use it to protect any wrongdoing of that corporate entity. Right. And now Obama's making the argument in reverse, which is really a flawed argument.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's what the New York Times was calling out today. To what extent, 70% of the NSA budget privatized, to what extent do you think what we're seeing here is an analog to the private prison industry problem, which is where we took part of the commons, our prisons, and we turned them over to for-profit corporations, and all of a sudden we've got literally in the halls of Congress lobbyists whose paychecks are written by for-profit prisons lobbying for stronger drug laws and longer sentences for you know, pick your crime, you know, whatever the most common kind of crime they can find. Jaywalking. Let's start putting people in prison for jaywalking.
Well, you know, the public comment, that's a very interesting angle that you take on the public commons. Most people don't really think of this public commons argument. It certainly has application here, the same way it does when we allow an industry to steal our water by way of polluting, when we allow an industry to ruin our parks by way of pollution or simple just overuse of the resources. But right. This is a public commons kind of argument, and it hasn't been well articulated. As a matter of fact, you're probably one of the few people talking about that, Tom.
I think this is the most important part of it, is I want good spies working for my government. And I want them to be working for me, right? In other words, I want them to be government employees.
Yes.
I don't want them to be working for the Bin Laden family and the Carlyle Group, and as Ed Snowden was. And I don't want them to have the power. You know, the NSA arguably can lobby Congress. I mean, but they can't really lobby them the way that Booz Allen Hamilton can. They can't go in and make $50,000 campaign donations to somebody's, 501, to their, what do you call it, super PAC.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas these private contractors that the NSA is handing billions of dollars off to, they're making these donations like there's no tomorrow.
And still occupy your point being, if I follow you correctly, and again, it is a very interesting point, is that the analogy is it is occupying that part of a public common, which is we own that. This is ours.
That's correct.
It's like a university that we pay, develop this new medicine, and then we give that thing that is part of the public commons to a private drug company.
It actually goes beyond that. It's that. There's actually a public good that comes out of spying, right? I mean, you know, national security is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
That public good gets corrupted when the process of spying simply becomes a way to make money, and the companies that are making the money doing the spying start lobbying for, oh, well, let us spy on this, let us spy on that, let us spy, you know, and pretty soon you've got 70% of the NSA budget going to for-profit corporations when I think it should be 0% of the budget should be going to for-profit corporations. It should, you know, none of this should be done with the profit motive. It should all be done with the national security motive.
We keep what we develop. Do you mind if I use that argument?
Please do.
it's really a very clever, interesting argument. I think it's right on point. There's not a sense of, you know, there used to be a discussion about public commons, whether it was the airways, whatever it was. We understood that there were certain things that we all are a part of and we all own. And I think if you take a look at everything that happened in the New Deal, I think there was a reemphasis of, you know, this is ours.
Yeah, and accountability as well. Accountability to and for that.
Isn't that part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and then this passenger's laptops. Now, this young man, there was some flags, I suppose, this kid coming back from Canada, but what's the story with this?
Well, I think you may disagree with me on this. I see this story a little bit different. It is that, there's Fourth Amendment issues, but the Fourth Amendment issues have at least been subject to legitimate changes that have taken away by whether it's the Patriot Act, even though I think that should be thrown out in total. But at least there are exceptions that have been drawn out. They've been made. It's just like the exigent circumstances, which is clearly a police officer busting into a house because of exigent circumstances. That clearly, if in a purist standpoint, is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. But the court says there are things that we have to adapt to. And I looked at this. I didn't think Judge Corman's reasoning was bad here.
Yeah.
If you take a look at what Corman said, he said, you know what, there are times when we have exigent circumstances kinds of analysis put upon us because of changing times. I thought it was actually a very well thought out decision. And this is a young man that he was an Islamic studies scholar. He had on his computer images of rallies of militant Islamic kind of jihad, kind of Hamas groups, you name it. It was all bundled in there together. And they said, look, we want to borrow your computer for 11 days and see if there's anything to all this.
And that's reasonable suspicion.
I think it is.
If it's not probable cause, then they didn't prosecute him.
That's exactly right. Now, I think to attack Corman for this decision is, frankly, he's not a bad judge.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty good decision.
No, I'm actually agreeing with you on this. I think I just, you know, how far are we going to go with this? It looks
well,
like,
that's always the question.
Yeah, that is always the question. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com, the website, the attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio. Pep, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the new year, too. It's the new year. What are your goals for this new year? Welcome back, Mike Pack. Pap, you're still with us?
I am.
Great. So tell us what's coming up on Ring of Fire TV over on Free Speech TV this week.
In the last couple of weeks, we've been changing the format that we're going to do some throughout the year occasionally and going more to the radio format. As you know, Stephanie Miller's now with the program on Free Speech TV. Bill Press is with the Free Speech TV. You are, of course, have always had a radio/magazine kind of format. We've been a magazine format, but every few weeks we're going to move into a radio discussion format. And so this week we've got some interviews with Henry Rollins, Paul Begala, Jim Hightower, Chris Hedges, some interviews we really like, and those are interviews we're going to be showing on Free Speech TV with some discussion in between, and some more recent stories that have been developing. So I never want to remain the same when we think we can kind of tweak things and give the viewing public a little more information in a little quicker format, and that's what we're going to try to do this week.
Yeah. Always look for ways to constantly improve. You know, Farron had sent me an email about or a note about this train that blew up. Did you want to get into that at all?
Yeah, well, I think that's an important discussion for so many reasons. Obviously, it has to do with deregulation. And
why don't you set it up first so people know
about? So what ended up happening is you had a train derailment in North Dakota where there was an explosion. They just now have started to get the problem under control. But what's happening is after the explosion, you had a fire that resulted with smoldering smoke spreading out through North Dakota for days and days. But the issue comes down to this. Canada has said to hell with the pipeline. You know, Canada said the XL pipeline doesn't look like government's ever going to do this. They're going to start using our railways more and more. Now, this was not a Canadian shipment, but this is the same analogy of what's happening in the U.S. People have started to say, look, we want to improve the shipment ability by using a railway system that doesn't have the infrastructure to handle it.
Right.
The increase of railway traffic has been tremendous. But with that increase of railroad traffic, they haven't kept up with the need to improve rails and bridges and places like that. And so what you have is North Dakota has almost become the new Saudi Arabia. I mean, the oil industry is huge up there. I think they've added 60 new terminals just in the last couple of years of refinery terminals, railway terminals to be able to move this oil throughout the country.
Wow.
But the problem is they're doing it at a pace where private industry is willing to say, you know what, sure, we'll increase our business in some places by as much as 500% or 600% based only on the transportation of oil and gas. But at the same time, they've made no effort to really build out an infrastructure that's modernized that should be able to handle that. Canada, for example, has said, you know what, we can't get away with what you're doing down in the United States. We have guidelines and we have regulations that don't allow us to be cowboys in the way that we transport oil. So what we're going to do is bring it down through North America over to the West Coast and then over to China or wherever else we're shipping it throughout the country, throughout the world. What's happened is infrastructure has not kept up with all that. And this is just one of the many disasters we're going to start seeing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Excellent point. Mike Papantonio and the show on Sundays here on Free Speech TV, Ring of Fire TV. And it's noon Sundays, right, Pap?
Thank you. Yes, it is.
And then it replays every day throughout the week. You can check the listings for it. Mike Papantonio, good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I asked this question as we were just going out of the last segment. It's a new year. What are your goals for the new year? One of my goals for the new year is to get more progressives in office. We have, it is now 2014. holy cow, this is our first show of 2014. I always used to hate the New Year's because I'm so bad with time. And I would always, you know, back in the days when you write checks, I always had the wrong year on them. And then people used to say, well, that check isn't valid. It's only good for 90 days. But anyhow, it's 2014. 2014 means midterm elections, November. In 11 months, we're going to be deciding who controls the House of Representatives and the Senate in just 11 months. So I think that's a pretty big deal. Frank in Staten Island, New York. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Good afternoon. I was listening before, and you were talking about that whole thing with conservatives and suicide and all that stuff.
Yeah.
A couple of issues ago, Time magazine did this whole thing about suicide, and the number that just yelled at me was that for men in their 50s, it's up like 50% or some crazy number.
Hmm.
And, you know, there's a person on the radio that says that men in their 50s are defined by the work they do.
Yeah.
And I tell you, that can't be more true, because when I lost my job 4 years ago, it's just like, no matter what you do, you're overqualified. You can't retrain yourself. That's a big myth. Nobody's going to hire anybody in their 60s or their late 50s, even if they do get retrained.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right, and I think that sense of I am what I do is really, particularly for men, and particularly for men of a certain age, is so solid, so much a part of us. How did you make it through, Frank?
Well, my wife works, but unfortunately, she did go through an issue with she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had to have a mammogram. The whole thing. So we pulled through that, but she's doing okay now. So that's basically, you know, what I'm doing now. So now the decision I have to make is, do I decide to collect Social Security?
Right.
You know, when I'm old enough, which is going to be in about a year,
right,
do I decide to do that or not? I don't know what to do.
Yeah, well, I can't offer you any advice on that. But it's like you're not alone. I mean, there are a lot of people in this country right now who are just, you know, between a rock and a hard spot, and we need to change that politically. This is the consequence of political decisions. That are made, you know, the rules of the game of capitalism are established by our legislatures. And this coming election will have an opportunity to change that. So, Frank, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Okay.
Were you going to add something?
Yeah, I have a lifelong friend. He just retired from a state worker. And he worked for 32 years with the Department of Labor in the state. And he retired because he didn't want to get part of furloughs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So now, you know, We talk, and he kind of is on the notion that everybody has their own problem. When there's so many of them, we can't afford it. Well, I'm going to point out the next time I speak, but look what they did in Detroit. They're going to do away with all those pensions.
Yeah.
You see, that's going to be the next big thing. And these people, I don't know.
Oh, they're figuring out every way they can to rob the middle class, Frank. I mean, that's what it comes right down to. It's they are figuring out every way they can to, you know, the middle class got too uppity. This is Russell Kirk predicted this in 1952, that if the middle class ever got rich enough, that they'd start demanding things. And sure enough, by the 60s and the 70s, you had, you know, young people saying, I won't go to war, and let's get high and let's have sex. And you had women saying, you know, we want equal rights with men. And you had African Americans saying, what about us? And you had gay people saying, we want to be recognized. And all of this stuff was the stuff that the conservatives had predicted back in the 50s, that the middle class got wealthy enough that they could start speaking out and demanding social justice. We want a union. We want to have a say in the workplace. We want decent wages. We want good benefits. And so they're just trying to strip down the middle class back down to poverty levels so that people will just be nice, compliant. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'll do what you say, sir. Tote that bag. Yep. No, you know, like that. I mean, that's what they're doing. And it's a sad thing. It's not the America that I grew up in. Frank, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. I was curious what the Vatican's take was on brain death. So I looked it up, and in 2008, they actually did a paper called The Pontifical Research Something-Something of the Vatican,
mm-hmm.
Why the concept of brain death is valid as a definition of death. And the two key points of the entire paper is that, A, they recognize brain death as death. It said brain death is death, number one.
Right.
Number two, after reviewing all the criteria and excluding what they considered anecdotal evidence, they said the authors of the paper conclude that using established medical criteria, the accuracy of the diagnosis of brain death is 100%.
Wow. Wow. So, and probably they had to do that because they own so many Catholic hospitals around the world, and they've got to come up with guidelines for their doctors. So,
yeah, extra series, it's the Pontifical Academy of Sciences Extra Series 31, if anyone wants to look it up.
And very, it's very interesting.
By the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in responses to objections, and the title, Why the Concept of Brain Death is Valid as a Definition of Death.
Right.
So,
right.
Death, that's all.
Okay, Bill, thanks a lot. That's great. That's fascinating. Renee in Judah, Wisconsin. Hey, Renee, we hit just a minute to the break. A quick one?
Yes. Basically, you know, you were saying that, you know, if it were me, I would want them to pull the, you know, I'd want them to pull the plug, but
right.
That was a medical decision that you were making on behalf of yourself.
That's correct.
And I think the family should be able to make that medical decision as well and not have the hospital say, well, your child is dead, so we should just pull the plug. It's a medical decision that the family should get.
Well, this also raises another interesting question. If I say, if I'm brain dead, pull the plug, and then I'm brain dead, I'm not around anymore. And what if my family says, you know, we want to just keep his body around for a while? And it's like the difference between being cremated or being buried or something. You know, it's like, you know, aren't funerals for the living, not for the dead? Shouldn't the living be able to make these decisions rather than the dead? Or have I just gone off on a total weird tangent here? I don't know. Renee, thank you for the call. It's an interesting question. But yeah, I'm increasingly inclined to think the family should be able to make the decision, but the family is not able to find a doctor who will operate on their daughter who is referred to as a corpse.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the situation may resolve itself rather quickly. We'll see. We'll see. The good, the bad, and the very, very multiversantly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, Ford. At an upcoming Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, the automaker will unveil its newest hybrid car, the C-Max Solar Energy. The C-Max Solar Energy is powered by a gasoline engine as well as a set of rooftop solar panels. Ford executives estimate that the car will get 100 miles per gallon, and the three-quarters of all trips will be powered by solar energy. They also say that owners of the C-Max Solar will reduce their annual greenhouse footprint by about 4 tons per year. And here's the best thing. Owners of the C-Max Solar Energy will get to buy American and go green all at the same time. The bad. Jim Garrow, the noted conspiracy theorist, went off the deep end during a recent appearance on right-wing pundit Eric Rush's radio show. He said that President Obama will fake an alien attack and then use the Canadian Army to suppress those people who know that the attack is fake. And why ask the Canadian Army, you might ask? Well, let's let Jim explain.
As you know full well, American troops swear allegiance to the Constitution and
yes.
Lawful authority and lawful order. Canadians don't. So now we have the introduction of a new element. A group of people in a position to overpower the population who have never sworn allegiance to the thing that is supposedly giving us the rule of law.
Right, Jim. Right. Then again, if the Canadians did invade us, who knows? We might actually get single-payer health care. And the very, very ugly, Stuart Varney. The Fox Business host said on Tuesday that the stranding of a Russian research ship in the Arctic proves that we should be worried about global cooling, not global warming. Seriously, take a look.
All 52 of the passengers aboard the research vessel stranded in the Antarctic ice have been rescued. The ship, sent to the Antarctic to study climate change, has been stranded in the ice for 10 days. Attempts to rescue the passengers using icebreaker ships failed. Rescuers finally got through using a whopping great big helicopter that was landing on the supposedly very thin ice. They're all out, okay? So it looks to me like we're looking at global cooling Forget this global warming. That's just my opinion. All right, Shah.
Right. That apparently is what passes for climate change coverage over at Fox so-called News and Fox Business these days. And that is very, very ugly. That's incredible. Okay, according to a New Jersey lawmaker, it looks like the closure of that bridge in New Jersey that was apparently Chris Christie punishing that Democratic mayor for not endorsing him for governor because he wanted a landslide so he could propel himself into the Republican presidential. It looks like it came from outside the agency, the order to close the bridge, which might mean the governor's office. We don't know. We're just all waiting to find out, aren't we? And Chris Christie's kind of hoping it'll go away, but... You know, I think people are figuring out this guy's a bully. You know, he's just a New Jersey bully. And, you know, New Jersey bullies are even better at being bullies than regular bullies. Because there's, you know, I mean, a lot of people from New Jersey are kind of proud of the attitude that comes along with it. But when you add that to bully, then it starts getting bad, right? I don't know. Maybe somebody from New Jersey wants to call and set me straight. Josie in China Grove, North Carolina. You're a retired ICU nurse?
Yes, 40 years. And my experience with critically ill people is that it doesn't matter what you want. It's what your family wants.
Right.
Unless you come to the hospital with your lawyer and your living will in your hand, and even then, if you become brain dead or comatose, mm-hmm. they will go to your family and say, what do you want us to do so you won't sue us?
Right.
So it really, in truth, does not matter what the individual wants. And I have seen people literally tortured to death. And it's cruel and it's against the Constitution what happens to some people in the hospital.
Well, go ahead.
We don't seem to be able to protect our patients.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate.
That kind of crazy.
And the point that I was making with the earlier caller about this is, I might leave behind a will, for example, that says, you know, please cremate me and sprinkle my ashes over, you know, Lake Michigan or something. I actually, frankly, haven't given that any thought, so I have no instructions with regard to that. But if I did, in reality, if I'm dead, I don't care. And if my wife decides that it would be much more meaningful to her to cremate me and keep me on the mantle in the living room, or for that matter, to bury me, you know, next to my parents up in Charlevoix or something like that, she should have the right to do that, in my opinion, because I'm dead. I agree with Thomas Jefferson, who talked about how the dead have no hold over the living. Now, he was saying this in the context of how every generation should have the right to essentially modify or rewrite the Constitution to meet changing times, which certainly is a good argument for revisiting the Second Amendment. But I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact words, but something like, you know, the dead should have no hold over the living. And now that... That said, I mean, what you're saying is that they end up then torturing the essentially dead to death.
With machinery that can carry you so far and no further. We just don't know yet
right. How
to get past a lot of the really damaging things that can happen to people.
Right.
So we make them linger and kind of experiment on them, really.
Yeah, and make a lot of money, by the way.
Oh, make fabulous amounts of money.
Yeah. And that's
capitalism. This is just my opinion, but capitalism destroys everything it touches, and it has destroyed healthcare.
Oh yeah, I would agree to an extent. I think capitalism has its place, but I think unregulated capitalism destroys pretty much everything it touches. Absolutely, and things that should be our commons, whether it's our spy agencies, our police departments, our prisons, or our hospitals. Should not be operated for profit. Josie, thank you for calling, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Bob in Marseilles, Illinois. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, you mentioned something when you were back on the subject of end-of-life problems that brought up something that this case in California was basically involved with ethics more than medicine.
Yes.
And I tend to agree, but if you look at medicine, everybody that has insurance in this country thinks we are a fairly advanced country as far as our medical treatment goes.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be, we are fairly advanced, but we aren't number one. We're like 20,
right.
And we're doing 20 at double the cost of number two.
Right.
And I got a feeling that I don't know if you realized it, but you just hit on an interesting thing. As far as ethics goes, I got a feeling we're in about the same shape.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned places in the afterlife for somebody that can lie us into a war that we shouldn't be in.
Right.
And I've got a feeling that goes along with the medical system as well. Medicine is not our only problem in this country.
No, it's these perverse incentives. It's systems that are designed with the profit motive at mind first and foremost, and the profit motive is fine as far as it goes, but it should not be making medical decisions for us. It should not be making other decisions for us. Bob, thanks for the call. Alan in Jefferson City, Tennessee. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hello. I want to talk about the economic damage caused when people are forced to buy private health insurance.
Okay.
If they paid on average an extra $250 a month for that private health insurance, which would be very reasonable considering the older you get, the more expensive it gets, put away in a dividend-bearing stock with a total return of about 8%. Over the course of 30 years, that's $320,000.
Which is about the cost of one person who's uninsured getting in a car accident and ending up in the ER for a week.
Yeah. Well,
that's the reason why everybody should have insurance, is because I don't want to be paying for that guy in the ER who decided that he was invincible and so he wasn't going to buy insurance. He thought he was going to end up with $300,000.
That's why we should have universal health insurance.
Right.
What I'm saying is the extra money when you have to buy the private insurance, you know, when you cannot get employer-sponsored health care.
Right.
When you cannot get...
Shouldn't health insurance just be a right, not a privilege? Shouldn't it be something that we all pay for through our taxes and that our government provides to all of us?
Absolutely. We all should have it.
I mean, just like our fire insurance is our fire department, right? Our
potential damage. That's... You there?
Yeah, I am, but we just hit the break, Alan. We'll have to carry. I have a feeling you wanted to go a whole lot deeper on this, and I'm sorry we're out of time. Give me a call later on in the week or next week, and we'll continue the conversation. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Did you catch where Ken Langone, this multimillionaire with Home Depot, says that the Pope is, like, not giving enough love to rich people? Really? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And James in Strasburg, Virginia. Hey, James, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Just want to let you know that your book is on its way to me.
Oh, great.
And I'm looking very much forward to reading it, and I just want to say thank you for everything that you do, because you're the only voice I've heard around here that speaks truth, and I'm so tired of listening to all the lies. You are a boon to this country.
Well, thank you. I do my best. I appreciate your kind words.
The reason that I called was because I've been listening to the talk on Snowden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason Snowden did what he did is because he understands something that we don't. And my thinking is, there was a concept when I was in high school that if you did something wrong, it would go on your permanent record.
Mm-hmm.
And given what you've been talking about with the economy and how the royalists are basically taking everything back from us that we gained over the last 40 to 50 years. I think that what they're doing is they're building a permanent record, and that as things go from bad to worse, which they will have that resource to use in interrogations, to use when they sweep people off the street. They will be able to go back through that and know what people have done for the last 10, 15 years.
Hmm.
And that's just something I think we need to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I don't disagree. You know, there's this concept, James, that when everybody's a criminal, that's when you have a true police state. And what the state does is it engages in selective enforcement of selective prosecutions. And if you can have enough laws, if you can have laws that, well, China does this, for example, it's against the law to move without the permission of the local police department. And yet more than a third of the entire population of China has moved in the last 10 years without permission. So if you do something that they don't like, they can simply say, at least for one out of three people, you broke the law, you moved when you shouldn't have, we're going to put you in jail for the next 5 years, and or whatever it is, you know, whatever the penalty is. And whether it's having downloaded a song illegally, which is a $300,000 fine and you can go to jail for, or whether it's forwarding a news story to a friend, an email, and violating the copyright law, which is, again, a $300,000 fine and you go to jail for, I would guess that probably pretty much everybody in America has committed a crime. And if the NSA is tracking everybody's email, you know, they know of that of everybody. And if they wanted to get into selective enforcement and just start bringing people down, this would be a way to do it. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I think that what we should all do is to change our name to Winston Smith.
Yeah, it was Winston Smith. Wait a minute, is that out of 1984?
Yes.
Ah, yeah, okay. James, thank you for the call. I get it. I definitely get it. Up next, Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, telling us what's going on in the world. Stick around. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, and Bob Ney on the line with us, a former congressman and now a reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Bob, and author of Sideswiped, the best book, if you want to know how Washington, D.C. works, which you should know. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I am great. Happy New Year. This is the first time we've talked in 2014.
That's right. And by the way, I was in prison with the kid that downloaded Star Wars. They gave him a year and a day.
Really? Apropos of the let me just set this up. I was before Bob came on, I was talking to a fellow who I was saying the way a police state works is if everybody's a criminal, then they decide to prosecute people selectively, and it's a $300,000 fine and a year in jail or more if you simply forward a news story to somebody, an email. It's a violation of the copyright law. And my guess, or a photograph. And my guess is that probably everybody in America, or 90% of Americans, have broken the law, have committed a crime. And the NSA now knows about all of those things. And if they really wanted to start selectively enforcing the laws and cracking down on people, they could. And then you come on and tell me the story again. You were in jail with...
I went to prison. I looked over, and this kid looked like he was, 12 years old.
Yeah.
And I asked him, "Who is that?" And they said, "Oh, he's 18. Just had turned 18. He downloaded Star Wars, and they gave him a year and a day."
Wow.
I thought, "Wow." So even pre-NSA days, now they can really get you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's scary. That's scary. We should add. You got caught up in that whole Jack Abramoff thing. You used to be one of those Republican congressmen. And now you're a decent and rational guy.
I try.
I appreciate you, Bob. I genuinely do. So what's going on in the world?
Well, it's the second day of healthcare, and it was quiet. You know, the whole thing's quiet. Nothing particularly alarming has come forth. And it you know, lists out clearly the changes. 2 million some people have went into the exchange with more expected to be there. The big deal is going to be Monday, a vote in the Senate with the, of course, with the jobless benefits vote. The House has said, well, we want it offset immediately. So there's going to be an argument how that would be done or where it would come from.
You're talking about extending the unemployment benefits, yes. which ran out the 3 days after Christmas for over a million Americans.
Yes, it ran out.
And the Republicans are saying we'll extend those unemployment benefits, but only if you take the money away from somebody else.
From somewhere, yes, and somewhere else. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that clashes out, because with this economy and those people sitting there with nothing, that political debate could become very, very hot on the public, you know, policy substance of it. And then the omnibus bill is taking shape. I think that's a bright spot. It means no government shutdown. Mm-hmm. And that was the work of staffers while the members left. Now the members come back and make the kind of tough calls, but that does seem to be progressing. The other big story is the Benghazi New York Times in depth report about, you know, the fact that it wasn't Al-Qaeda. And I think that really, I would imagine Congressman Issa will not, who likes to have the hearings, he's the chairman of the Oversight Government Committee, he may not be able to embark on any more hearings on Benghazi. And staying in the Mideast, Secretary of State Kerry's in Israel today and Ramallah. In Ramallah, he'll meet with the Palestinians. In Jerusalem, he'll meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I can guarantee you the big topic that's going to come up is going to be Iran more than the Palestinians, because Israel and Saudi Arabia are furious over President Obama's arrangement with many countries beyond us and the Iranians over the nuclear.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, I suspect you share this perspective. One of the best things that could happen for world peace is if Rouhani, the new president of Iran?
Yes.
If President Rouhani, in fact, a friend of mine is an Iranian, went over and talked with him a few weeks ago. If President Rouhani were to actually engage in reasonable talks with the United States, and we were to bring them into the family of nations as a signatory to the nuclear test ban treaty, or not the whatever it is.
Yeah, I think this is one of the greatest initiatives by President Obama in 3 decades towards something constructive on this, and they just need to give him a few more months to continue to negotiate instead of trying to, you know, chop it out from under him.
Yeah. But they're really committed to just trying to destroy this presidency no matter what, whether it's through the economy or through Iran or amazing.
Yeah, okay. Senator McCain's made some obnoxious statements really about Secretary of State Kerry.
Yeah.
And how he's, you know, on this destruction path. It's really obnoxious statements. There's nothing that the Secretary of State's done that's in a harmful way. It's more constructive talks.
Yeah. Well, John McCain never saw a war he didn't like.
No, that's
so
true.
What else is up?
Well, the only other thing is the South Sudan. It's a big deal because of my friend and your friend, Ellen Ratner. South Sudan is just it's a tragedy. And yeah. It doesn't they're trying to negotiate some peace talks, but it just doesn't look good at all.
Yeah. You know, I went there with Ellen. Did she drag you down there?
I was to be there January 10th of this year, as we speak. In a few days, I was to leave, and that, of course, has been canceled. I was going to be on the way with her.
Yeah, we did our show from there about 3 years ago, I said she dragged me down there. Yeah, I was very glad to go. It was quite an honor. And, boy, a rough place, a rough part of the world, and it's so sad what's going on right now.
Oh, it is. It's really, really a shame.
Yeah. You said this omnibus budget bill is looks like it's going to clean up. Does that mean that this whole debt ceiling thing, there had been talk about the Republicans were going to hold the debt ceiling hostage again in January or February or whenever it comes up, that's going to go away?
Well, yes. The Tea Party has been told, well, our real fight's going to be the debt ceiling. And that's going to be a false threat, too, because anybody who supports these budgets, basically the debt ceiling is paying for something they voted on before this debt ceiling talk comes about. Those are previous budgets.
But that was true the last time, and they used the debt ceiling argument.
But they won't be able to...
You don't think they can pull it off again?
No, you know, they can't.
Yeah, good. Well, it's good that, you know, the old don't let facts get in the way of a good argument kind of thing isn't going to work anymore.
So. That's correct.
Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped and reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you so much.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Republicans sure do love their donut holes. Really, seriously. Back in 2003, Republicans in Congress, with the help of President Bush, passed what they called the Medicare Modernization Act, which created Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D helps lower the cost of prescription drugs for Americans enrolled in Medicare through government subsidies. Let me translate that into English. Medicare Part D pays for your drugs if you're on Medicare. Unfortunately, there's a gap in how much the government is willing to pay for prescription costs under Medicare Part D, and that gap is known as the Medicare donut hole. For example, you spend up to $2,700 on prescriptions. In 2009, the government paid for most, if not all, your expenses. But if you spent anywhere between $2,700 and $6,400 in 2009, those costs come straight out of your pocket. The government doesn't pay a dime because you're in the donut hole, right? If you hit $6,000 or more in prescription expenses, the government, again, picks up most of your tab. So fortunately, Obamacare addresses the Medicare Part D donut hole and is helping make prescription drugs under Part D more affordable. Thanks to Obamacare, Americans who fall into the donut hole will receive a $250 rebate within 3 months of reaching it to help pay for prescriptions. And there's a discount on covered brand name drugs and some good stuff, generic drugs, whatnot. The Medicare Part D donut hole is slowly being phased out and will be completely closed by 2020. But as one donut hole is closing, another one is opening up. It's the red state donut hole. When the Supreme Court ruled on Obamacare, Chief Justice John Roberts and the rest of the right-wingers on the bench left it up to the states to decide whether to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. And thanks to that decision, 25 states, which are either controlled by a Republican governor or have a Republican legislature, have refused to expand Medicaid coverage to their citizens under Obamacare in what are purely political moves. I mean, consider this, the federal government is paying 100% of the cost of Medicaid expansion through all the way through 2016, and 90% of the cost after that. But as a result of the Republican refusal to expand Medicaid in those 25 states, around 5 million Americans aren't going to have access to health care in 2014 because they find themselves in the red state donut hole. So what does that red state donut hole look like? Let's take a look at it. Texas, where Governor Rick Perry has refused to expand Medicaid. In Texas in 2014, Medicaid will cover the health expenses of Texans who have a family of three and who make up to 19% of the federal poverty level, roughly $3,700 a year. You make $3,800 a year, you do not qualify for Medicaid. You're too rich in Texas. Seriously. But Texans whose annual income falls between 19% and 100% of the federal poverty level will be without access to health care under Medicaid. And they make up nearly a million of the 5 million Americans that fall into that red state donut hole. Texans who make more than 100% of the federal poverty level, that's $19,530, they'll be able to get health care coverage under Obamacare with a subsidy. And basically for free. So if you make between $3,700 a year and $19,500 a year, and you live in a blue state, you get free health care through the Medicaid expansion. But if you make more than $3,700 but less than $19,500 a year and live in Texas, you're screwed. The government won't give you a penny to help with your medical expenses because Rick Perry won't take that federal money. And pretty much the same is true in every other Republican-run state in the country. Thanks to partisan politics, 5 million Americans are being left without health care coverage this year in 2014. 5 million Americans won't be able to afford routine physicals, life-saving medications, or health care of any kind. And most importantly, 5 million Americans are being denied the services that they've already paid for with their own tax dollars. It's time for Republicans across the country to put politics aside and to put the interests of the most vulnerable of Americans first by fully expanding Medicaid coverage under Obamacare. Let's close that red state donut hole once and for all. Call your lawmakers and tell them that saving lives is more important than playing politics. So, okay, we covered a lot today. this young woman, 13 years old, who lives in California. She's trying to get out to New York for surgery. Jahi McMath, I think is her name. My apologies if I mispronounce it. The hospital and all the doctors say she's brain dead, and therefore she is a corpse, and they will not do further surgeries on her. And in order for her to be moved from California to New York, she needs a surgery done so that she can be put on an airplane, and they won't do it. And her family's trying to find somebody who will, but the hospital's saying she's dead. Let her die. Let her die with dignity. Let her go. Now, what makes this even worse is that she was a perfectly healthy kid who went in for a tonsillectomy, and now she's dead, or at least brain dead. And you know, I thought this was, I guessed when Louise and Sean and I were kicking this around this morning talking about it, and Shane and Danielle and Jim and I guessed that most people would call and say, you know, if the hospital says she's dead, if the doctors say she's dead, if there's an absolute 100% consensus, if modern medical science says she's dead, let her die. Let her go. But most of the calls I've gotten have been from people saying, her family should be able to do whatever they want. And if what they want to do is keep her on a ventilator or keep her breathing or put a feeding tube in her or whatever, keep her going for years and years, even if there's no one home, that should be their decision. Now, assuming somebody's paying the bills, and I'm assuming because the hospital screwed up this tonsillectomy that their insurance company is going to pay the bills. Although, who knows? I mean, I don't know all the details of this thing. But most of the people who've been calling have been saying, leave it up to the family. And that's where, you know, and I had this epiphany where, you know, I've said, you know, I have, Louise and I said to each other this morning when we were talking about this, you know, if I'm ever brain dead, pull a plug on me. Just do it. Get on with your life. I mean, that's what I would want Louise to do. But what if she doesn't want to do that? I mean, you know, you just don't, you never know until the day comes, right? Talk is cheap. So what if the day comes and I'm laying there and the doc says, well, he's brain dead. And Louise says, well, you know, I'd like to, you know, come by and kiss his forehead every day for the next week or two. So keep him alive for a while. Who am I to say no? I'm dead. Right? I mean, I'm not there. Thomas Jefferson said, the earth belongs to the living, not to the dead. I think he's right. So as much as I might want to have all these advanced directives and everything, it's really, and then we had a nurse who called up and she said, you know, I worked in the ER for 40 years. And unless you walk in with the living will in one hand and your lawyer in your other, you know, holding hands with your lawyer in your other hand, your family is going to make the decision. Because the hospital doesn't want to get sued. They're going to go along with whatever your family wants. So, it's an interesting one. What do we do about this? Meanwhile, the New York Times is calling for Ed Snowden to get clemency because he is a whistleblower. I'm totally down with that. And we are seeing an explosion of the symptoms of mental illness among young people. And frankly, I think it's happening right across America as a consequence of unemployment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In other words, Republican economic policies have created a mental health crisis in the United States. Well, they were a mental health crisis to begin with, of course. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Terry in Pahrump, Nevada. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Doesn't it sound like there should be a rim shot right after you say that city?
Yeah, I suppose.
Two things real quick. Whenever someone tells me that single payer is a bad idea, I right away ask them, are you for legalization of crack or heroin? And they always say no.
Mm-hmm.
My belief is wishing to turn a profit off someone else's misery. That's immoral. That's right. Basically the same as being a heroin or a crack dealer. I just don't understand the concept. Second thing, real quickly, I found a website called presidentialdata.org.
Okay.
Breaks down what the presidents have spent since the Second World War, penny by penny, jobs created, everything. Totally refutes anything you will ever hear on Fox. So if anybody wants to argue with you about, you know, who is really the big government, big spender, point them to presidentialdata.org. All compiled from the abstracts from the government, labor boards, all that good stuff.
I'm looking at it right now. Budget deficits, the Republicans are overwhelmingly responsible for them. Business investment seems to happen most aggressively during... I'm sorry?
55 million jobs created during Democrats to 38 million during Republicans. It just breaks it down entirely. It's an amazing site.
Yeah. Presidentialdata.org, you're right. And it's all footnoted and everything. It's very, very clean.
Complete annotations, bibliographies are spotless. It's a really good site.
Yeah. The stock market goes up during Democrats, goes down during Republicans.
Yep.
It's job growth goes, with the single exception of Jerry Ford, job growth goes up during Democrats and down during, it's lower during Republicans.
And we do have to agree that in one aspect, and it does break it down by year if you wanted to. It explains how they compile it so that you don't, you know, jump over one year to another as presidents are changed.
Right.
But we do have to understand that one of those Republican presidents, at least, would be considered a bleeding heart liberal by today's standards, Eisenhower.
Right.
He spent money on what we needed to have money spent on. So I don't have a problem with him. But as far as the rest of them go, it just totally refutes everything you're going to hear from the uber conservatives.
Yeah. Well, even Eisenhower didn't turn out all that good. Of course, he had a Republican Congress, too. Well, no, he didn't have a Republican House. He did not have a Republican Congress, actually.
But at least he spent money on the country.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
That's true. There was a pretty bad recession. There were a couple of pretty bad recessions in the 50s during the Eisenhower years, though. I remember my dad being out of work in 55.
Well, one of my favorite things on there is it points out 9 out of the last 10 recessions were caused by Republican presidents. It's a great site. Huh. And single payer, I totally agree with you. It's the only way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I mean,
misery.
This is a moral issue, an economic issue, a common sense issue. At the very least, we should have had a public option so that Medicare could compete in the marketplace against all these for-profit companies because they would just kick their butts. They'd totally kick their butts. Terry, thanks for the call. Thanks for the presidentialdata.org site. I will spread that around. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's Thursday, so let's get geeky on global warming. We all know that climate change is the greatest threat that our species has ever faced, but it could be even worse than predicted. That, according to a new study published in the journal Nature. That study found that climate change could cause global temperatures to rise by at least 4 degrees Celsius at 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit by the year 2100. The scientists behind the study came to this conclusion by looking at the role that clouds play in moderating temperatures on the planet. They found that as the planet continues to warm, there will be fewer clouds that are able to reflect the sun's rays, meaning temperatures will continue to rise. Stephen Sherwood, the lead researcher on the study, told The Guardian that 4 degrees Celsius would likely be catastrophic rather than simply dangerous. For example, it would make life difficult, if not impossible, in much of the tropics, and would guarantee the eventual melting of the Greenland ice sheet and some of the Antarctic ice sheet. Unless we act now, these newly predicted temperatures are going to make it even harder for mankind and the rest of the animal kingdom, and frankly the plant kingdom, to survive. And that includes organisms that are living in some of the darkest, coldest, and deepest environments on Earth that were once thought to be untouchable. A study published in the journal Global Change Biology shows that thanks to climate change and global warming, seafloor marine life will decrease by as much as 38% in the North Atlantic Ocean. Up to 5% globally just over the next 100 years. Organisms that live in the deepest depths of the ocean rely pretty heavily on the remains of marine life that lives on or near the ocean surface that settles down and they eat this stuff, right? As a result, the health of surface ocean waters has a huge impact on the health of deep ocean waters and the organisms that call them home. So as nutrients are being depleted on the surface of the ocean thanks to climate change, organisms living in deep ocean waters are unable to get the nutrients and food they need to survive. These findings on deep sea marine life are proof that when it comes to climate change and its effects, nothing is out of reach. To learn more about the greatest threat our species has ever faced and what's driving it, head on over to lasthours.org and check out our new documentary, The Last Hours of Humanity. It's pretty amazing stuff. Michael in Park Forest. Hey, Michael. You were brain dead?
I was considered brain dead.
Tell me about it.
They told the wife to grieve.
Right.
They told mom 9 to 10 odds. Mom said, who are you lying to? Ma'am, we thought you heard us talking to the wife. He's not going to chance. In 7 days, I was talking.
Yeah. Now, 9 out of 10 odds is different from this is it.
Well, that's the way of talking to these Catholics from Chicago. They said that I would never walk, never drive a car. They missed both those. The most important thing, I've been telling people, you say that people from the government hear us. They hear our phone conversations.
Right.
Now, they've been hearing me for the last almost 20 years. It started in 94.
Mm-hmm.
Been telling people what they can do. Mom said Matthew 21:21, faith, mustard seed of faith, moving a mountain.
Right.
That has worked for I can't tell you how many people. They got to know the answer's there. They know it. They've heard it.
Right. So your position on this is that the family should keep this 13-year-old's body going in the hopes that her brain will come back the way yours did.
Amen.
Okay, I got it, Michael. I got it. And like I said, I'm increasingly thinking that it really just should be up to the family that simple. Michael, thank you for the call. Mark in Montgomery, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year to you.
I listened to your conversation about the Red State Donut Hole, and I wanted to call you because I think there's some political dynamite here, Tom, if the Democrats play their cards right, and Ronald Reagan is going to save the Affordable Care Act.
How so? The ghost
of Reagan... through the EMTALA Act of 1986, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act that he signed into law.
Right. This is the law that said that if you show up at an ER, they have to take you in even
if you
don't have insurance.
Now, with Medicaid expansion, undocumented immigrants cannot even buy into the exchanges or get Medicaid expansion, so they're going to use the emergency room, so you're going to have those costs.
Well, they already are.
And yes, but and with the Medicaid expansion, the disproportionate share hospitals are supposed to reduce their budget by $17 billion between 2014 and 2020. Now, if they're not accepting the Medicaid expansion, Tom, those hospital emergency rooms are going to be screaming bloody murder for funds.
Well, that's what Jan Brewer said.
Hospital administrators are going to close down those hospitals.
That's what Jan Brewer said. I mean, that was the rationale that the governor, the Republican governor of Arizona, used when she forced her Republican legislature to take the Medicare expansion. And the governor of Mississippi today came out and said, well, I'm not going to take the federal money because, you know, someday they could stop giving it to me, which makes no sense to me. It's like, you know, I'm not going to take this job because someday I might get fired. Really? I'm not going to eat this meal because someday I might be hungry. It just makes no sense. But in any case, that's his rationale. And he said, and they said, well, what about Jan Brewer? She said, you know, I'm going to take the money over, you know, because my hospitals need it anyway, you know, to cover the cost of ERs and things. And he's like, well, we'll just have a difference of opinion. I think you're right.
But politically for the Democrats, I don't know if you're going to speak with Bernie tomorrow, but
we will.
If they can hold hearings with hospital administrators that are going to say, we have to close our emergency rooms because these recalcitrant governors won't accept this money, and show that this is going to become a civil rights issue, that people are not going to have access to health care, and we can sue the government the way they sued during Brown versus Board of Education because of unequal treatment, we could do it with health care and finally get single payer. And the Republicans are doing this to themselves.
Wow. Use the 14th Amendment. Huh. Equal protection under the law.
They're digging their own hole, Tom, and if we play this right, we can really...
Some Democrat in the Senate needs to play Daryl Issa and start holding hearings. You're absolutely right. It's just the question is, who's it going to be? It's going to have to be a committee chair. Bernie is the chair of the Veterans Committee. I don't know that this is going to help or hurt the veterans, though. I don't think that he'll have the platform to do that, but it'll be... I'll see if I can... I'll try to remember to raise it with him. Mark, that's a great suggestion. The ghost of Reagan is going to save the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obama. Interesting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think the most amazing thing about this is that these Republican governors are saying to the people in their states, you know those tax dollars you sent to Washington, D.C.? I'm not going to let them come back to the state. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Very interesting, you know, how the rich, a couple of things. I want to get on somebody to, maybe you have some thoughts on this, on how to respond to this. I walked out of the TV studios today, out of the building. It was just, you know, an office building. Walked out of the office building, and here's a guy on the street, not unreasonable, you know, he didn't look like some totally crazed person or anything like that. He said, sir, and I said, I looked at him and said, yeah. And he said, would you buy me a meal? And I was in a hurry and, well, I guess my excuse is that at a certain level, I'm thinking, will you pay me to stand here and ask you every day to buy me a meal? Which is really arguably bad thinking, but it's also good logic, I suppose. What's his name? Who is the Chicago School of Economics, the economist? Anyhow, I said no, and I just kept on walking. I was in a hurry. I came over here, and all the way over here, I was regretting it. Because we were just a block away from Outbound Pain, you know, and I could have walked in and said, here, give this guy some soup. Here's my credit card. And, you know, I hope I see him there tomorrow because I will say yes and I will do that and we'll see what happens. Chris, what's his name? Chris Murphy, senator from Kentucky, spent a day with a homeless man yesterday or the day before. And it tells the story over at Think Progress, thinkprogress.org. And I got here after having that experience. And, I mean, you run across panhandlers here in Washington, D.C. every day, every place. But this guy was different. And he wasn't saying spare change or give me a buck. He was saying, would you buy me a meal? And I read the story of Chris Murphy and what he did with this homeless guy and what they did through the day and what their routine was and everything. And it made me feel even more convinced that I should have bought this guy the meal. And those of you who have been watching for a lot of years know that a year or two ago I went through something similar to this, where this woman in Union Station was asking me to buy her food, and I was like, I should have done that. For some reason, I mean, it so reminds me of Matthew 25. You know, I was hungry and you didn't feed me. And it just seems like a whole different thing than, hey, give me a buck. Which may just be a less articulate way of saying, will you buy me a meal? So anyhow, what I'd like to do is get somebody on the program who can, how do you respond to that? How do you help the homeless? And there's record numbers of them in the United States. How do you help the poor in ways that don't cause them to show up on that same street corner day after day in even greater numbers? And I realize this is the Rush Limbaugh logic. But are there agencies? Was there some number that I could have called? And is there someplace I could have taken this guy here in Washington, D.C. or anyplace else? What do you do? Or you just say, sure, yeah, come with me. I'll walk you over to the store. You know, whatever you'd like to buy, whatever you'd like to eat, pick it out. I'll pay for it. Or do you say, here's $5. Good luck. Although I think that probably all I had at the time was British pounds. Well, no, I have a couple 20s in my pocket, so I could have given him a 20. So anyhow. But I think that the reason why that particular question, this is the second time in 3 years somebody's asked me that question, why it agonizes me, is I keep remembering, you know, I was hungry, you did not feed me, I was homeless, I was naked, you did not clothe me, I was thirsty, you did not. And it just echoes in my head. I mean, it's so much the way I was raised. And in fact, Charlotte has some thoughts on that. Hey, Charlotte.
Hi. Well, Scripture tells you not to worry about it, that go ahead and give the money.
Right.
And the growth spiritually that you gain from it, even if he spent it on marijuana or drugs or whatever,
right,
is worth the effort for you to be kind and give them the money they are asking for.
Right. But I can – here's another experience that I had, Charlotte, that – when I was 16 or 17, I spent, it must have been the summer that I was 17, I spent a month in San Francisco and in living in Haight-Ashbury, and I had no visible means of support, and my parents did not send me any money, and I was panhandling. I was on the street panhandling, but I was, you know, a white kid panhandling. I mean, I was not in desperation or anything. There was a bunch of us who were living in an apartment that said rent strike, you know, and it was really just free living. And you know, you could always find somebody to take you in. I mean, it was the 60s. It was the summer of love in San Francisco. But what I knew was that there were certain corners where I could panhandle more effectively than others. And so, you know, and it was mostly places where the tourists came, like the corner of Haight and Ashbury or the corner of Fell Street and Ashbury. And there was competition for those corners, you know, among the various panhandlers.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me doesn't want to say to somebody, yes, this is a good place for you to stand every day and ask people for money. Because shouldn't we be able to just kind of go on about our lives without somebody in our face asking for money every day?
Right, but you have to consider the times, and all that you've said in all of your programs is the time that we're living in now.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
And also, this isn't set up by mistake, and it's not set up for him to get the money. It's set up for your spiritual growth.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and I blew it.
But you'll have another opportunity.
I'm sure I will. I'm sure I will, and I will take it. Charlotte, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching in Fresno. Thank you for a very thoughtful response. Sarah in Young America, New Mexico, or Minnesota. Hey, Sarah, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for listening to KTNF.
Hi, real quick. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to call and say I used to live in Chicago, and I used to live in West Palm Beach, Florida, where both cities have very high panhandling rates.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought that crossed my mind was I had a homeless lady ask me one time in a fast food restaurant. I was sitting down. I finished most of my meal, but not all of it. And when I was done, she asked me if she could eat my leftovers. And without thinking twice, I gave it to her.
Sure.
But then later on, I regretted that I didn't just buy her own meal. And I've also shared similar thoughts where, is this person just going to ask every day? Are they going to turn around and buy drugs with the money? But in all honesty, when you posed the question, the thought that crossed my mind was, it's the risk that you take.
Yeah.
And sometimes,
well, if somebody buys drugs with the money, that's fine with me, frankly. I mean, I don't care.
Yeah.
So much what they do with it, I would like that to be basic necessities, but who am I to make that judgment?
Oh, I understand, and I agree with that. But, I guess the bottom line to my thought was, I think I'm a lot like you were. I totally believe in funding programs to help support people, which are being drastically reduced.
Right.
And I think that we as communities and the communities where we live, let's just take that risk, regardless of where they plan on spending the money.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can, let's just try to help them and give them the meal.
Yeah.
Or maybe the money to help pay rent. If we're in a situation where at times I can do that to help people. But sometimes for myself, I have to let go, wondering what are they going to do with it, and just give them the help.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you. Sarah, thank you for the call. Thank you. It's very a very good one. Paul in Hudson, Massachusetts. Hey, Paul.
Hey, thank you for having me, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment. I am now unemployed at this time. I'm hanging on by a thread, and the federal budget didn't pass unemployment extension or long-term unemployed, and so I'm only a moment away from being homeless, and I just would think that we could do something for people who are on the street, who don't have shelter, who don't have food. I think that we need to make places for people to be able to go,
yeah,
to get themselves up and off the ground.
Right. Well, right next
shelter places,
right next door to where I work, where the TV studio is the place where they publish the Street Sense newspaper. And I always give money to the Street Sense newspaper people when I walk by. And I buy, and I just, whatever bill happens to be on the outside of the wad, and it's usually a 5 or a 10, and sometimes a 20.
I think that's wonderful.
I buy those because I know that those people are in a program. And but that's a judgment thing, right? And who am I to judge these people? It's like, that's a very kind of, anyway. Paul, you want to make a final comment here? We've got 10 seconds.
Yes. I used to make over 6 figures, and I'm at a point now where I am just about homeless.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to look at what's going on in this country.
I'm with you. It could have been you there, Paul. Paul, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And someday it could be me. And it could be any of us. This is, after all, America. With Republicans. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Charlotte in Somerville, South Carolina. You wanted to comment on Medicare Part D and people being brain dead? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Hey, welcome. And hi to your dog.
That's a whole other story.
Okay. So what's up?
I just wanted to mention that there are a lot of us on Medicare Part D that are paying a lot more for the insurance than we are for our medications.
That's interesting.
I mean, I get the cheapest plan I can get, you know, just to keep it down.
Right.
But I pay twice as much for the insurance as I do for the medications.
So why not go off the insurance and just buy the medications? Because you're concerned that you'll get sicker and need the more expensive medications?
If at some time I ever need Medicare Part D, really, I'll have a 1% increase in my premium for every month I'm not insured. So I have to keep it. And that's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, that covers the whole program.
Right.
Which is something you hear about people getting upset about the ACA.
Right. I think that all of this stuff is nonsense. And it should just be, you know, you show up, you say, here's my Social Security number. They say, here's your medicine, here's your medical care, here's your surgery, whatever. No copays, no, you know, nothing. I mean, it just should be like in Canada, you know. You pay $150 a year, a month, and that's it. You know, or in Mexico, you pay $240 a year. Or in Germany, you just pay your taxes every month, whatever your income tax happens to be. And then you show up and they care for you.
Right. 40 years ago, my husband was working for Michelin. He was in France. Mm-hmm. He had to go to the doctor. He wasn't charged.
Right. Oh, I went to a German hospital when we were living there. I had what I later learned was a panic attack. I thought it was a heart attack. I went to the German hospital. And after I was all done with all the tests and everything, and they had reassured me and given me a couple milligrams of Valium and sent me on my way, I went looking for, you know, okay, where do I pay? And they don't have a billing office. They had nobody there who could take money.
That's, you know, forget about the insurance company. At any rate, the other thing is about that kid in California, and I feel terrible for her family.
Yes, me too.
I know they're devastated, but it's not necessarily that anybody did anything wrong.
Right. No, stuff happens. I mean, it could just be...
Stuff happens.
Yeah.
And sometimes even a tiny, tiny error that you'll never find starts a whole cascade of disasters.
Right. Right.
You know, I've seen it and I've been there. And you can't blame anybody. I realize what her family is going through. My daughter went through that with my ex-husband, you know, wound up with a brain hemorrhage.
Yeah.
And it's difficult.
Yeah.
So I know that. But I say, you know, you can't really blame anybody. If this ever goes to court, I'm sure the records will be sealed.
Right.
So the information won't get out. But tonsillectomy all by itself, regardless of any other procedure, is a hazardous procedure.
Hmm. Interesting. Charlotte, thank you for calling and sharing with us. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Sherry in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Sherry.
Hi, Tom.
You have some thoughts on how to help the homeless?
Oh, yes, I wanted to share that. My son and I have been in a difficult situation where we lost everything that we had due to domestic violence and child support and stalking. So I've been there where you don't have anything and you need help, you know, not even having their own home. So that's made me a lot more compassionate in helping people. I actually volunteered for Salvation Army, and that's a great place. When I give what I can. I don't have a lot, but when I do have something, I give.
Yeah.
To people and help them out, and I give food. No questions asked. It's just, I'll just help you. And I'm at that point right now, being able to do that and give freely and not want to micromanage people and worry, you know, what are they going to do with what I give them?
Sure.
It's like a gift. If I give it, it's yours. You do what you want with it.
That's right.
That kind of thing. But if I don't have money, I always direct people to the Salvation Army because there they can go in and eat, and it will help people out that way. One of the things that I think of all the time, too, you mentioned napkin about feeding people and clothing and that type of thing. And also, I'm a Christian, and in the Bible there's also the story about the man with all the grain in his storehouse, and he wouldn't share it with anybody, and then he ends up dying. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it's like, well, why didn't you do this? So when I see people in need, I think to myself, you never know when it's your last moment. This might be the last thing I get to do.
Right.
You know, this might be my last act on earth, is to feed someone who's hungry or help somebody out that way. It might be the last time I not only get to help somebody, but the very last thing that I do.
Right.
So, you know, you can't take it with you. So it's like, you don't know. You know, if somebody's just asking for food, why not?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah.
Sure, I wish I could do it over again. I really do.
Oh, sure. I've been there, too, where it's like, gosh, I wish I'd given that. There was a time I was in the bus, and I saw this homeless man. Clearly, he was homeless and smelled and everything else, but I really felt badly for him. My heart goes out. You never know people's stories, too. And that's the other thing. We never know what people are going through. And another young kid passed by him and made a really nasty remark about this guy being homeless. And clearly, he was already feeling ashamed. And this just dug that knife in deeper with this man. And it was cold. I wanted to help him, but I didn't want to point him out on the bus. I didn't want to make him feel worse. And I was just sitting there thinking, how can I approach this guy without embarrassing him further, you know,
mm-hmm.
to be able to help him? So that was one that I regretted because I really wanted to help him, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to hurt him any more than he'd already been hurt.
Yeah.
But, I'm just at that place now. The thing that always pops in my head, somebody's asking me for food, is just, that might be the last thing I get to do.
Yeah, that's an incredible way to think of it. That's an incredible way to think of it. Sherry, thank you for that gift.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Dave in Batavia, Illinois. Hey, Dave.
Hi. Love your show. I have a son who was homeless, disabled son who was homeless for a couple of years, actually. We got him into some HUD.
Mm-hmm.
Subsidized apartment eventually, but, my sense of how to respond to requests for help is to be proactive, learn what the resources are in your community. I was confronted by a homeless person who held up a sign, you know, need this, need that, and I directed that person to the helping agency in my community and you know, I don't know if she knew that they were there, but she said, oh, my gosh, I'll check that out. And I told her roughly where they were located.
Right.
I think that's important because individual, you know, $5 or whatever is, it may actually help. And we could say, well, you know, we can wonder whether it helped or not. But, you know, the information is really powerful, you know, and most communities do have helping agencies and they can deal with the various problems that people have. There's, there are disabilities, there are dislocations and so on, and you know, get people in front of people that are professionals that can help out. And I think we have the luxury of that in our nation because of, the development of a professional.
Yeah, but there's the problem is that so many of these agencies are so overwhelmed. Homeless shelters turn away people every night because they're full. There's the resources that they operate under, they're being slashed by these budget cuts.
And you let them sleep at your house.
Yeah.
If that's the fact.
Yeah.
If you know that's the fact. You know, there's knowledge, you know, and and then there are possibilities for people. So there's no question about that. I mean, I have two sons that are disabled, and one that needs, they're at the age of majority now, but we're going to continue to be there helping parents and advocates for many years. There's no question. And, you know, there are 5-year waiting lists at the kind of placement that my one more severely affected son, you know, needs. I mean, we're aware of that situation. And so it's a question of what do we do now, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, we try to provide the supports that are needed. And there's no continuum of care. There's no question about that.
Good point. Dave, I just have 1 minute left in the show. I want to get another caller in here, if I may. So thank you for the call. Jesse in Maryville, Indiana. You had some thoughts on feeding the homeless?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Great show. It's not even a question that has an easy answer, but just a small example. I used to drive this route in Chicago, and I would see this guy homeless, and I mean, smelled horrible, and I would always reach down and give him a $5, you know, whatever.
Sure.
And I'd always say, "Don't drink it, partner," you know. You know, and I probably shouldn't even have said that, but I mean, and I legitimately meant it, you know, and I prayed yeah. about it. This went on for about a year. Then one day I didn't see him at all. And I had even been telling my wife, you know, I should probably take this guy like some clothes and soap and toiletries.
Right.
And actually the day that I was going to hand it to him, I never saw the guy.
Huh.
And didn't see him at all. Well, about a month later, I see an individual on the same corner. And this guy, and it was, you know, really hot summer, and there was a...
You got to wrap it up, Jesse. You just got 20 seconds, 10 seconds.
He was selling cold drinks and everything up. Well, it turns out it was that same homeless guy.
Huh.
So, I mean, I actually... and I didn't say, hey, I used to give you $5, but...
But he had become... He had started a business. Huh.
Yeah.
Amazing. That's wonderful. Jesse, thanks for the story. Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. And Democracy Begins with You. Tag, you're it.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.